Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
The names of many of the so-called robber barons of the late 19th and early 20th centuries are largely known to us due to the concrete ways they chose to distribute their wealth. Andrew Carnegie, his name lives on through the concert hall and libraries, Cornelius Vanderbilt through the university, Rockefeller to the amazing Rockefeller Center. But then there is Jay Gould. According to Mark Twain, Jay Gould was the mightiest disaster which has ever befallen this country. The people had desired money before his day, but he taught them to fall down and worship it.
Gould was at one time one of the most famous people in America, but today Gould is best known, to the extent he's remembered at all, for his role in Black Friday, the day he blew up the gold market and brought the financial system to near collapse. But while the Gould story is filled with acts of mind-boggling corruption and bribery, he also played a major role in building the railroads that were so important to the nation's economic development. The Jay Gould story is laid out in engaging detail in Greg Steinmetz's new book, American Rascal: How Jay Gould Built Wall Street's Biggest Fortune. We're lucky to have Mr. Steinmetz with us this morning. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start with a little bit about you. What motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Well, I've been writing about business in one form or another for, gosh, maybe close to 40 years. I used to be a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. I'm now in the money management business. I'm an analyst with an investment firm, and I still am writing about businesses every day. I just find business really interesting. I wrote a book several years ago about a banker from the Renaissance named Jacob Fugger. And I wrote a book about him because I started it when I was the Berlin bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal. And here was a figure whose name was like Rockefeller in Germany, very important in the history of finance, in the history of the world, in fact, because of his role in starting the Reformation. But no one in the U.S. had ever heard of him. So I said, okay, as every journalist, I want to write a book. So I wrote that book. And now with Jay Gould, it was the same thing. I talked to, you know, intelligent, educated people who know their history every day. When I mentioned Jay Gould, their eyes blank over. And here's a guy who is clearly every bit as important and influential, and I would say even more interesting than the three that you mentioned, Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Vanderbilt, but people don't know about him. So there is the opportunity as a writer to do something that maybe would open some eyes.
Can you share a bit about Gould's background and upbringing?
Gould was born dirt poor on a farm up in the Catskills, about 100 miles north of New York City. It was a childhood marked by tragedy. Two of his sisters died when they were young of tuberculosis. His mother died when he was only 4 years old. The only memory Gould has of her is kissing her wet, her dry lips when he went to say goodbye to her. That's all he remembers about his mother. He subsequently had two stepmothers who also died. So Gould was raised by his sisters and by his father, who's an alcoholic. And I think what motivated Gould to become what he became was just to make so much money that he could spare his own family from all the hardship he suffered personally.
So let's talk about how he gets into the business world. What's his first significant business venture, and how did he end up becoming involved in finance?
Well, his first significant business venture was a tanning factory in the Poconos. He learned about it from a brother-in-law. At the time, he was making money as a surveyor and a map maker. He went with a financial backer to explore that part of the Poconos. He found a massive hemlock grove. Hemlock is the tree that you use to tan leather. You strip the bark off the tree, you boil it up, you toss the cowhides in there, and voila, you have leather. That led him to Wall Street, because the place in the U.S. where tans were traded most actively was right where Wall Street stands today. There was already stock trading going on down there. Gould discovered that there is more money to be made in the buying and selling of whatever it is, whether it's leather or whether it's securities, than there is in producing the stuff. So that led him to Wall Street, and the rest is history.
Gould's career intertwines with that of Cornelius Vanderbilt on a number of occasions. One episode that gives some perspective on the corruption of the time involves Vanderbilt's effort to build the Harlem Railroad. What happened there?
Well, it's a great story, the clash between Gould and Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt owned the New York Central, the Harlem, and the Hudson. He wanted the monopoly in New York State so he could charge more, but he couldn't get that because the Erie Railroad wasn't just going through Pennsylvania. It started up near Buffalo. So to get a lock on New York Rail, he needed the Erie. He tried to acquire it or at least neutralize it. Gould stepped in a fight between Vanderbilt and the guy who was in charge of it, a notorious financier named Daniel Drew. Gould made himself the middleman in that fight by buying up proxies, which gave him the ability to vote the stock, even though he didn't actually own the stock, and he could acquire those for a song. It's very smart what he did. Put himself in the middle of this proxy fight and ended up taking control of the Erie himself. And from that day on, Vanderbilt hated him, but he also respected him, because one thing he said about Gould was, when asked who the smartest businessman in the country was, he said, Jay Gould.
And there's a remarkable, but by the way, one of the extraordinary things about this book is the kinds of things these people do, which today would be illegal for a dozen different ways, but are just overtly and dramatically corrupt. Talk a little bit about the fight between, I think it was Gould and Vanderbilt, that involved the New York legislature and a series of bribes.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the things that were legal at the time. You know, if I were to ask you if you could trade on inside information and you knew about a merger in the works, you know, would you do it? If you were CEO of a publicly held company with thousands of stockholders, but your brother owned a printing business on the side and you could divert all your printing activity to your brother, you know, would you do it? Now you'd have to disclose it. Gould did this kind of stuff. It was morally reprehensible in some cases, but it was legal. So you can't necessarily fault him on that. What you can fault him on, and that's what you just talked about, the bribery was incredible. And Gould talked about how, first, with Vanderbilt, there was a bidding war for the New York legislature. Vanderbilt went up there with a suitcase full of cash using Boss Tweed as his bagman. Boss Tweed, of course, was the power broker in New York in those days. And Gould went up there with an even bigger suitcase full of cash. He paid it more than Vanderbilt was willing to pay. He ended up getting the New York legislature to pass a law that actually said that Vanderbilt wasn't allowed to buy the Erie Railroad, so he won. Vanderbilt rolled over because he thought that, okay, that they may have passed that law, but that law is not going to stand because I've got the judges in New York in my back pocket because I'm paying them off. But it turns out that Gould got in with the judges too and bested Vanderbilt because of his underhanded, sneaky ways of bribing not only legislatures but also judges. Incredible corruption.
And on the morally reprehensible side, the other thing, episode that really amused me was where I believe Gould is about to issue more stock, and I think it's in the Erie, and because he knows that the act of issuing the stock is likely to cause the price to go down, and at the same time he shorts it. Did he really do that?
Oh, yeah. He did it, and nowadays, if you were to issue more stock, you'd have to tell shareholders before you did it. Because by flooding the market with stock, just like you flood the market with anything, you devalue it. So he did this without Vanderbilt knowing about it. And also, Vanderbilt didn't see this coming, because the law was that there was a court injunction, actually, that said Erie couldn't issue any more stock. So I thought, well, if these guys were to do that, there would be contempt of the law, and they could end up in jail for committing fraud. Gould and his buddy Jim Fisk did it anyway, and that caught Vanderbilt completely on surprise, left him flat-footed, and again, because the judges were in Gould's pocket by this time, he got away with it. Or at least he was able to negotiate a settlement with Vanderbilt that put him in control of the Erie instead of Vanderbilt.
The Black Friday gold melt, the gold melt down was an extraordinary event. Can you set out some background about the relationships between gold and the dollar and how it affects different interest groups in the country, including gold's attempt to influence President Grant?
Yeah. The, you know, as right now we have what's called a fiat currency, where there's nothing standing behind it except the fact that if I give you $5 for a coffee, you will accept that $5 and give me the coffee. Before the Civil War, there was gold standing behind it. We're on the gold standard. You could take your notes to the bank and say, okay, I've got $10 here, give me $10 worth of gold. They would give it to you. The Civil War was so expensive that the North just didn't have enough money, enough gold in the treasury to finance all it needed for the war, to pay for the soldiers, pay for supplies, etc. So they went onto this fake currency, which was very controversial at the time, but people believed, well, the North is going to win, and eventually it would go back to the gold standard, and they will buy back greenbacks, as they were called, in gold. So merchants would take the greenbacks, and we could all transact as if there was gold behind it. But what that meant is, because there was some doubt about whether the government would fulfill its pledge to redeem the greenbacks with gold, the price of gold and the price of greenbacks fluctuated. So at one point, when things were looking bad for the North during the Civil War, what used to be a dollar's worth of gold buying a dollar worth of greenbacks, you would need like $2.50 worth of greenbacks to buy gold. So you can speculate in gold just like you could anything else. And what Gould did was, he said, okay, here's an opportunity. Everyone thinks that the natural drift of the greenback price would be to fall closer to gold, and that the price of gold, the inverse of that, would go up and up and up. Gould said, well, if I can get the president to reverse that policy and go in the other direction, I can make a lot of money. No one believed that the administration wanted this to happen to the gold price. But Gould, first he tried to bribe Grant. Grant was, although he was surrounded by a lot of corrupt people, was incorruptible himself, but he was able to convince him that the gold price should be allowed to move in the way that Gould wanted it to do. And that's what happened. And as Gould was buying gold, taking advantage of this, the people on the other side, the short sellers of the gold, were convinced that at any moment the administration would come in, flood the market with gold, destroy gold. And in order to get the better of them, Gould sent in his buddy, this guy Jim Fisk, who was fraudulently agreeing to just buy gold at ever higher prices. And it all ended up blowing up, and financial markets closed, and some people got financially destroyed, lost their shirts. Fisk and Gould should have both gone to jail. But again, because of their influence with the judges, none of that ever happened.
Gould also ends up getting involved. Another thing that's really wonderful about the book is the way you keep running into these historical figures. It's like, you know, Gould ends up, you know, knowing everybody. So, I mean, there's interactions with Thomas Edison. One of the things that does happen, though, is Gould eventually gets involved with Western Union. Tell us about that. Can you share a little bit about that story?
Yeah. Well, the thing about Telegraph is it just makes sense to run telegraph lines parallel to railroads. What happened with Western Union was they got deals with all the railroads to string their wires along the roads. It made sense that you would have, you know, one big telegraph company because it was one big network, instead of having to change from my wires to your wires once across state lines or something. The forces in favor of there being a monopoly were just overwhelming. So we have this Western Union monopoly. Gould owned a lot of railroads. He thought, well, I don't want to have to just lease my lines to Western Union. I want to own Western Union itself. He figures, okay, I got to do something to bid down the price of Western Union to make it affordable, because it was a very expensive company, because it made a ton of money. The first way he tried was he involved Edison. Edison was the expert on telegraphy. He started his career as a wireless operator, and he had a way to send messages over telegraph wires faster than what Western Union was doing. Gould partners with Edison, and turns out that the technology wasn't quite there yet. So that didn't work, and it for a while it it hurt the price of Western Union when Gould started talking about it, but not enough to where he could make it where it was enticing enough for Gould to buy the whole thing or affordable enough. A couple years later, he owned even more railroads when he was partnered with Edison. And because he owned so many railroads, he had some leverage over Western Union. So he canceled his contracts with Western Union, probably illegally, but he wasn't paying Western Union regardless of whether it was legal or not. So Western Union wasn't as making as much money as it used to. The stock price in Western Union fell. The board of directors of Western Union got very antsy about that. Gould, meanwhile, was buying up stock in Western Union, and he got to the point where he had more votes than the Vanderbilts, who were in charge of Western Union at the time. He ends up ousting the Vanderbilts and takes control of Western Union and has a cable monopoly.
And let's talk a little bit about Gould as an operator. A lot of the book, you know, sort of highlights these extraordinary shenanigans and corruption that sort of pervaded the time. But, you know, Gould obviously ended up owning a lot of things. Was he a good operator of the companies that he bought?
He was good enough. He managed the business, as we would say today, for cash flow. He would spend money where he thought he would get a good return, build a line into a new town or something like that. But for the most part, he was just trying to watch costs as much as he was trying to grow the things. And he used the cash that he generated to buy more railroads. So was he a good operator? If you look at his safety record of his railroad, wasn't too good. If you looked at the quality of his cars, locomotives, they weren't that good, but they were good enough. He wasn't trying to win customers with good service. He wanted to do just the minimum it took to maximize his cash flow.
I want to go back before we run out of time to a story about the Harlem Railroad. Last season, HBO had a wonderful limited series called The Gilded Age, and there was a plot line in there where someone was trying to build a railroad in the city of New York, and they bribed a bunch of city councilmen, and then the councilman tried to turn on him. This sounded a lot like the story you told about Vanderbilt. Can you share that story a little bit?
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring it up, because that show, yes, that episode was based on Vanderbilt, but the main character in that Gilded Age show is Gould, and I'll tell you about that. But first, I'll tell you about the Harlem. The New York City lawmakers, the city council, as it were, they had to grant Vanderbilt a license to extend the railroad down from Park Avenue to make it go downtown. From 42nd Street, where you now have Grand Central, they realized, okay, if I give Vanderbilt, the Harlem Railroad, the rights to do this, the stock in Harlem Railroad is going to go up. So we're all going to buy a bunch of stock in Harlem before it goes up. And then after we give it to them, we're just going to take that permission back, and the price is going to fall. And we're going to sell the stock before we do that. We're going to short sell it. And they thought, oh, this is foolproof. We have a yo-yo here. We can make the stock go up. We can make it go down. Vanderbilt was not stupid, obviously. He recognized that there was this possibility. He got advance word of it. And the thing about short selling is the way you do it technically is you borrow someone else's stock and you sell that stock. And then hopefully after the price goes down, you buy it back and give it back to the guy who loaned you the stock. But Vanderbilt, very cleverly, he bought up all the stock that he could, risked an enormous amount of his fortune to do that. But he knew if he just completely restricted the supply of stock that the councilman wouldn't have anywhere to go to buy the stock except to pay enormous prices to get people to part with it. And that person who would part with it was Vanderbilt. So that's what he did, and he had them begging for relief here. And ultimately, because, well, there's still the city council, they still have some power over me, I'm going to let them settle. I'm going to sell them. I'm going to buy back some of their stock and get them off the hook. But he commanded a very high price, and it bankrupted several of them. And he had a good laugh about it, and he had an even better laugh when he did the same thing exactly a year later with the New York State lawmakers. They learned nothing from what happened in the city. And so the George Russell character in the Gilded Age book, the reason I say that he's more Gould than Vanderbilt is, one, he looks like Gould with the beard, and he has this loving relationship with his wife and family that Vanderbilt did not have. And that allowed the producers of the show to have a character who lied, cheated, and stole, just like the other robber barons, but also had this very warm and sympathetic side because he was all about family. And the driving tension of that show is the desire of the Gould family to break into New York society and befriend the Astors and get invited to their parties, which they're excluded from because they were nouveau riche. And in Gould's life, that was something that Gould and his wife tried to do, and they had less success than they do in the TV show.
As we wrap up, I want to talk about why you can't hate Gould properly. You know, you write that, you know, despite the fact that he lied and he cheated, you're not going to hate him. And why is that?
Well, one reason is what I just mentioned. As a family man, he was exemplary. So he had a very sympathetic side. The other thing is, and this is what Edison said, he said that, you know, these money men are what they are. They're all about doing whatever it takes to make money. But you have to admire Gould because he was just so good at what he did. It would be easier to hate him if he was a crook and he flopped. But because he was just a master at the game, you have to admire him, just like you would admire a skilled poker player.
Oh, I appreciate that. We have been having a great discussion with the author of American Rascal, How Jay Gould Built Wall Street's Biggest Fortune. Greg Steinmetz, thank you for joining us this morning on Mountain Money.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
A major event in the crypto industry has happened, Ethereum's merge, which proponents say could boost crypto prices in the long run and significantly change the future of cryptocurrency. Malika Mitra, reporter for Money, joins us this morning to help us understand the merge and what it means for the cryptocurrency industry. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
To understand this change, let's begin with an overview about how cryptocurrency works.
Sure. So cryptocurrency runs on something called the blockchain. A blockchain is essentially a digital database that records things in a chronological order. So think of information being kept in blocks linked together on a chain. And that information, in the case of cryptocurrency, is records of transactions, so the sender and the receiver, when transaction took place, how much it was for, that kind of thing. And so those blocks also have a unique set of numbers and letters to identify them. Those are called hashes. And each block has its own hash, but then also the one of the block before it. So that's how they're kind of all linked together. So what makes this kind of different from other digital databases? First of all, that data is stored on many servers across many locations. The aim of that is to have better performance and transparency because the network, the entire network can kind of see what's going on in there and fix issues as they arise. The other thing that makes it unique is that once it's added, it can't be changed. New data, that is. So if new data is added, it's then verified by the entire network and it can't be altered after that. So I know that's all a bit complicated, but overall the way this works is that new data enters the blockchain, a block is created for that data, the block is then broadcast to the whole network, the participants at work then choose to approve the new block or not, and if it's approved by the majority, it's added to the chain. So blockchain can be used for lots of things, but like you said, cryptocurrency is kind of the main one that people are familiar with.
And I think the greatest analogy for me is thinking of it like a ledger book. Each block is like a line in a ledger book, what's been happening.
Yeah, that's a really good way to think about it.
So, enter, you know, we've all heard about crypto, we've watched it go up and down, enter merge. What is, Ethereum, I take it, is one of the larger cryptocurrencies, and what are they doing with merge?
Yeah, so Ether is actually the name of the cryptocurrency, the kind of native cryptocurrency of the Ethereum blockchain. So Bitcoin is probably the one that most people have heard of. That's the biggest, and then Ether. And so kind of going back to the blockchain, there are two main methods for how new blocks are created in a blockchain: proof of work and proof of stake. And so the Ethereum merge essentially transitioned the Ethereum blockchain from one to the other. So proof of work is the system that Bitcoin uses and that Ethereum used prior to this merge. And the way that works is participants in the network are kind of competing directly to solve complicated math problems. This isn't someone, you know, sitting in their room with a calculator and a pencil, but it's big networks of computers that are running different solutions, and the winner gets to create a new block. But proof of stake, which is what Ethereum just transitioned to, and that event is called the merge, works by having participants selected somewhat at random to create new blocks, but they can enhance their chances of being picked by holding more of that network's currency or staking that currency. So why this matters so much? You might have heard about environmental concerns around Bitcoin. And that stems from it using the proof of work model. So all of those computers across a big network trying to solve those math problems, that uses a ton of energy. So by switching to the proof of stake model, Ethereum was able to cut its energy consumption by a lot, by around 99% is what the Ethereum Foundation says.
Which is very significant. How long has the merge been planned? And were the goals purely to become more sustainable?
So this kind of sets the groundwork for other things that the Ethereum network wanted to have happen. So, for example, making transactions faster and more efficient. There's kind of this misconception that the merge automatically made transactions more faster and efficient, but it really just kind of sets the groundwork for them to do that in the future. But so the environmental aspect was a big part of it. And as far as how long this has been planned, you mentioned, it's been a long time. So Ethereum's co-founder, I think, raised the possibility back in 2014 about switching to proof of stake. Yeah, and Ethereum was only founded in 2013. So it's been years. It's been pushed back a ton. Even this year, you know, it was supposed to happen a few months earlier. But in the end, the merge did happen on September 15th.
By planting this digital stake in the ground, is Ethereum likely to be leading a fundamental change across other cryptocurrencies? In other words, is everyone going to have to change to keep up with this due to the power impact?
So that's a big question, is kind of what this means for the rest of the crypto market. I mean, Ethereum advocates are, you know, very quick to say that, you know, Bitcoin, to point out the environmental concerns of Bitcoin. So I think there's definitely pressure across the crypto space to kind of, compete, especially because I think the environmental concerns of Bitcoin have become so much more like out in the open. You know, I think as cryptocurrency becomes more mainstream, this is something people are talking about, is the environmental aspect of it. So definitely, I think that there'll be pressure for sure. But it was a hard, you know, long time coming, and it was not easy to make this change.
When you talk about it not being easy, as I was prepping for this interview, I read that it was similar to swapping out an engine in a running car. Were the worries that, you know, this wouldn't work? I mean, was that a possibility?
Definitely. So this was a massive change to a huge network. You know, a lot of the kind of crypto experts that I interview all the time were saying that this is, you know, what the biggest event in the crypto space that's happened so far, and the biggest kind of attempt at making a change like this successfully. And so there are a lot of crypto projects that are powered by the Ethereum blockchain, so there was a lot at stake here. And there were definitely worries about it, you know, not going according to plan, which is why it was pushed back several times. You know, there's the high stakes, like I mentioned, of those crypto projects, but also they needed to kind of be developing the technology need to make this change. And also, of course, with crypto, there are security issues and things like that needed to be addressed.
And I take it it's up and running at this point, so the notion that it, quote, won't work is rapidly being dispelled?
Yeah, I think right now, like, the merge has happened for Ethereum. I mean, you know, there's always the possibility of issues arising that maybe weren't foreseen and things like that. But as of right now, the merge has taken place, yeah.
How does the merge impact those currently holding cryptocurrency, whether Ether or Bitcoin?
So not much. If you're just someone who holds crypto via an exchange like Coinbase or a trading app, or just, you know, in your Venmo or PayPal account, which is how some people hold crypto now, there's nothing that you have to do. It shouldn't impact you. That's whether you hold Bitcoin or Ether or another crypto. One thing to keep in mind is that scams run pretty rampant in the crypto space. Mm. So if anyone is reaching out to you, telling you you have to send them Ether or, you know, that there's some action you have to take, that's a scam, most likely. So I would just keep that in mind. You know, if you are kind of more deep in the crypto space, this does give you an option to stake your Ether and kind of be involved in that process. But I would say for most people, this isn't going to impact you. You know, there's also the aspect that if you're someone who holds crypto or is thinking about it and the environmental aspect was concerning to you, which I think is the case for a lot of people, now there is a less environmentally, you know, harmful option.
That answer sort of creates two questions in my mind about the sort of mainstreaming of crypto. First one is, I went into the convenience store out at the Kimball Junction the other day, and there was an ATM machine, and next to it was a thing that looked like a Bitcoin machine. And I'm wondering, who goes into a convenience store to buy Bitcoin, and what do these sort of kiosks do? Have you seen these things?
Yeah, I've seen those, and those are, yeah, they're popping up in places that everybody probably visits. So yeah, it's interesting. I think as far as what this means for kind of crypto overall, the merge, but also, you know, the popping up of things like Bitcoin ATMs, it's definitely being pushed into the mainstream a lot more. And so I would think that maybe a more popular way right now still is. You know, buying Bitcoin, you know, I'm not sure how many people are using the ATMs, but there are so many ways to buy Bitcoin now. Like I mentioned, you can open up your Venmo account, which, you know, a lot of people have.
I want to rabbit hole on that one for a second. So, because I found that out prepping for this interview, and I had no idea that you can do this now on Venmo. Is that a way to cash out, or is that a way to pay?
So via Venmo, you are just like holding the cryptocurrency, as far as my understanding. So you're not necessarily like making payments via Venmo crypto payments via Venmo, if that makes sense. But like in the way that some people use Robinhood, the investing app, to hold crypto, you can do so on your Venmo. That's been going on for a bit now. Same with PayPal.
So I would buy my crypto on an exchange of some kind, but have it held in my Venmo account?
You can actually buy and sell crypto in the accounts, like in the app itself.
Inside Venmo.
Yeah. I do want to, of course, preface this with that I'm by no means recommending that.
Head on down to that.
There are a lot of risks that come with crypto.
Head on down to that ATM today, right?
The merge benefits more than just cryptocurrency. What other marketplaces are going to be seeing benefits of this?
Yeah, so it's maybe hard to say a lot of the benefits right now, but I would say there's definitely an impact on digital marketplaces. Ethereum is one of the main network that some other technologies you might have heard of kind of rely on, so like non-fungible tokens or NFTs, as you might have heard them called, and decentralized finance applications, which are financial products and services that run on blockchain as opposed to kind of relying on an intermediary like a bank. And so those will likely in some way be impacted by the merge too.
And obviously there's an outside world that looks at crypto. What has been the impact, if anything, on cryptocurrencies in general from a valuation perspective as a result of the merge? And let's talk about Ether in particular. Has the value of Ether gone up because of this?
So going into the merge, when there was all this excitement, and like I said, this has been years in the making, but once it became pretty obvious this was going to happen mid-September, the prices definitely got a bump, especially Ether. After the merge, the markets have been pretty muted. I think Ether's price now is down a bit, actually, since the merge took place, Bitcoin's as well. But, you know, we also have to keep in mind that this is coming at a time when financial markets in general have suffered, much in part because of high inflation and the Federal Reserve hiking interest rates, and all these things are going on. So there are a lot of factors kind of at play when it comes to crypto prices right now.
That's really interesting, because I guess I would not have necessarily have thought that crypto would move parallel to the rest of the financial markets, because it is such a different beast. Has that been a pattern that we've seen over time, that crypto moves in parallel to the sort of regular stock markets?
So recently, we actually have a story coming out at money.com today about this, about how crypto and stock prices have moved similarly this year. A lot of that is because crypto is, gaining a lot of adoption by institutional investors. So that's going to make it kind of move more closely in with other financial markets, but also it's a risk asset. So as investors are, wanting to remove risk from their portfolio, crypto is a part of that. But it's still, crypto is still a very different financial instrument from stocks. The fundamentals and everything are incredibly different. So we definitely can't look at the future and say, oh, crypto and stocks move in tandem now. That's not the case.
Yeah, it's interesting, because unlike stocks, where there's an underlying asset, crypto is what it is, right? It's sort of there as almost like its own fiat currency. So you have to sort of wonder over time what would make it go up and down.
Right. And there are so many different factors. I mean, we've seen it plunge or soar. Dogecoin has done that based on Elon Musk tweeting one thing, So there's so many different factors that kind of play into this. And you can't, with stocks, investors can look at earnings reports, right, and things like that. You do that with crypto.
Well, we appreciate the time you've spent with us today. We're speaking with Malika Mitra. She's a reporter for Money. Malika, thank you for being on Mountain Money.
Thank you for having me.
Wasatch Brew Pub's Rick Seven is joining us this morning to discuss the restaurant's ownership change and their Fun at the Top weekends in the Loft and Tap Room. Rick, thanks for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Wasatch Brew Pub began in 1986, and actually the Wasatch Brewery, I should say, and it established itself as the very first brewery in Utah. This year, the label's restaurants came back under local ownership. Can you talk about a little bit what happened and what are the benefits of having the ownership back with locals?
Yeah, and yeah, the Wasatch Brew Pub actually opened up in 1989 and was the first brew pub in Utah. Greg Scherf, a local legend here, worked with the Utah State Legislature to get this to happen. And 2 months later, Squatters Pub Brewery in Salt Lake opened by Peter Cole and Jeff Polychronis. Now, these two guys are part of the local group that brought Wasatch Brew Pub, the Roadhouse Grill and Pub, and five other restaurants back under local ownership. They had been bought out by a capital investment group out east. Peter Cole has a residence in Park City. The Polychronis family owned Mount Air Cafe for 30 years before it became the Roadhouse Grill. So being part of the community and being local, they have vested interest not only in making the restaurant a success, but also helping our employees, about 90% of which do live local here up in Park City. We're all dedicated to making the community stronger by working with and supporting local nonprofits, including local public radio stations ABCW. We work to buy local organic food, support other local companies, and help to protect and preserve the beautiful local environment up here. Park City local means a lot to us because a lot of our ownership and our staff are Park City local.
No, and that makes sense. And I know, in the community, we talk a lot about, that local ownership and the importance and that connection. So, you've got some stuff going on, and it's called Fun at the Top Weekends. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, and that's a phrase we coined because, you know, Sunday Fun Day left out Saturday, and we just didn't think that was all that fair. So, but Wasatch, upstairs at Wasatch Brew Pub is our 21 and over bar called the Loft Bar and Tap Room. So both weekend days, we have, you know, $4 mimosas, $4 Bloody Marys with a Bloody Mary bar with all the fixings. We just got a big screen TV put in upstairs, so it's a great place to watch college football on Saturdays, go Utes, and the NFL on Sundays. So, you know, we have our full delicious menu up there, but we also offer a $1 legendary buffalo wings, and, you know, we have some great games on the deck. There's a gorgeous deck on the second floor, like giant Jenga and cornhole, and we're continually working to perpetuate a lot more fun upstairs at Wasatch.
Okay, now I need to back, yeah, maybe you have the same questions I do. Go first, please.
I have a different question, but go ahead.
Okay. $4 drinks?
$4 drinks. $4. It's not a special. It's a $4 mimosa and a $4 Bloody Mary on weekends, yeah.
All day?
All day. All day. And it opens up at 10:30 on weekends. The DABS allows us to start serving at 10:30, so.
Okay, just clarifying. Wanted to make sure that, you know, we got all the information.
One thing that you haven't touched on, are you still running the Wednesday night trivia?
We are. We are. It's live. It's game night live trivia every Wednesday at 7 o'clock and 8 o'clock. There's two different games. Great fun. It's free to play, and you can win prizes, which are a lot of food and delicious non-alcoholic beverages up at Wasatch.
Okay, so what can people find? Okay, so we talked about the Loft Bar. That's I take it open every day, right?
We're getting to get every day. Right now, it's okay. Weekends for sure.
Just
weekends right now. But we are working, well, Wednesdays we're open up for the trivia. And actually, it's Thursdays we are starting, well, every month we have a brewery comedy tour that comes in. And so this Thursday up in the tap room, there's going to be a comedy. It's called the Brewery Comedy Tour.
So, Rick, how many facilities fall under this umbrella now?
So we've got a total of 7. Up here in Park City, we've got the Roadhouse Grill and Pub, and then we have the Wasatch Brew Pub up here. If you're ever down to Salt Lake, I mean, every once in a while you guys get down there to visit it, right?
Not often, but...
Squatter's Brew Pub down there and the Wasatch Brew Pub in Sugar House. There's 2 airport locations, so if you're ever leaving or coming back into this great location, stop by there. And then right next to, there's a little place called the Craft Cafe, which is out in the International Center. That's where our home office is, and it's open for lunch like 10 to 3 o'clock.
What's the International Center?
The International Center is kind of where Amazon has their area.
Thank you.
It's just a bunch of warehouses, a bunch of office buildings out there. Kind of unknown, just a couple exits past the airport.
No, but you're out there serving that community.
Exactly.
As well.
There's a lot of new hotels that are popping up there.
So, you know, one of the things that people always talk about in business, you know, the key, location, location, location. The Wasatch Brew Pub is located at the very top of a very steep street. How has it kind of, you know, overcome those barriers and become, you know, one of the must-see places on Main Street?
And it's sort of tough because a lot of businesses and a lot of events have focused down at the bottom of Main. What people don't really, what people don't realize is at the top of the Main, the air is so much better up here than down there. It's like you should get up here. Park City's done a pretty decent job of public transport, getting people up here. It's free. It's actually pretty amazing. Even on crowded days, you can park, bus in. The trolley takes you up to the top as well. And, you know, oddly enough, our water is some of the best water you'll find in Park City because to make beer, you have to have the prime ingredient is water. And so the better the water, the better the beer. So after your hike up here and you're thirsty, you have a nice cold glass of water followed by a couple glasses of beer. And but all that, you know, and just having a great combination of delicious food, great beer, and amazing, amazing staff. And Wasatch Brew Pub is a historical, very iconic location. So you come up and you have a beer in part of Utah history.
Before we go, for years, the Wasatch Brewing has had a number of sort of clever slogans, starting with, we drink our share and sell the rest, bring some home for the wives with the polygamy porter. What else have you got coming in terms of who does that clever marketing and what else is coming?
Well, so it's one thing that's great about drinking beer is it stimulates creativity. Peter Cole came up down for Squatters in Salt Lake City, came up with Good for What Ails You.
Right.
So we'll be working on a lot of new great concepts. clubs coming up. One of the greatest ones I heard was kind of based off of The Chasing Tail. It's I've only had seven, or so I've only had one in dog beers. And so I can't take credit for that, but it's Wasatch and Squatters, it's all kind of about perpetuating this delicious irreverence that, you know, what it's sort of, when beer started in Utah, it was, like I always say, Greg Scherf is kind of the Joseph Smith of beer in Utah. I don't say that often. but there's something fun about beer. There's something just a little naughty about it.
That works for all of us. We've been speaking with Rick Seven. He is with the Wasatch Brew Pub. And he was telling us about all that we can expect when we go up there, especially with regards to Fun at the Top weekends. Rick, thanks for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.